This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. It's budget season, and state lawmakers are negotiating their priorities. But things have changed this year. Republicans no longer have a supermajority in the legislature, and that means they may not be able to override a veto of the budget. So how will that affect negotiations? WUNC Capitol Bureau Chief Jeff DeBeery has been reporting on the budget and other headlines in Raleigh and joins me now from the legislature. Welcome back, Jeff.
Hey there, Frank.
Where are we in the budget-making process?
Protracted, marathon-esque budget proceedings are now having gone through the ceremonial governor's proposal. We've had the House establish a budget, and the Senate has established a budget. So right now, in likely the next week to two, a number of legislators from both chambers are getting together to hash out the differences and what will emerge as a conference report, a compromise between the two chambers. And that budget from the legislature will then go over to the governor.
All right. So what are some of the key differences between the Senate and the House versions at this moment?
One of the big dollar line items is going to amount to raises. Raises for teachers, raises for state employees. The House put in its budget more money for teacher raises. The Senate has, to some extent, unexpectedly more, 5% for rank-and-file state employees. House has significantly more money for relief efforts following Florence, Hurricane Florence and the flooding, the aftermath. And also, there's a notable difference in the funding for DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality. And the House has much more in the way of appropriations for testing of water contaminants. So those are, and there are plenty of other differences, but those are some of the bigger differences that they're going to work through here in short order.
Now you say work through, negotiations, two chambers, but not two parties necessarily, although the math is a little bit different this year. What part does the Democratic Party play, and what role does losing the supermajority play in any of this, if at all?
It certainly, the Democrats have a seat, either a more prominent seat at the table or a seat that's closer to the table. I think it's probably, it's not totally fair to call this divided government. We don't really have divided government per se, but by virtue of the supermajorities being upended, being expired, it means we think that the governor is going to be able to hold a veto with a little bit more frequency. As a reminder, Governor Roy Cooper, the Democrat, he vetoed 28 pieces of legislation during his first two terms in office, and 23 of those were overridden. So when we think about a party line vote, if the legislature is to put forth a budget proposal, send it to the governor, and he vetoes it, if it comes back and Democrats are unified, they're not going to have the votes to override it. So then it becomes a question of, is the legislature working with, negotiating with the governor to see what it is that he wants or what it is that's going to make this more appealing to some of the Democrats? Or conversely, is the legislature going to be able to offer something to sweeten the pot or twist some arms or do something to convince Democrats to vote to override the governor's presumed or possible veto? We don't know for a fact that he's going to veto the budget. Should note that.
Well, sure, because we don't know what's in it yet. But here's the interesting thing in terms of the seat, if not a seat at the table, at least a place in the room where there's a table, because you have this interesting dynamic. The Republicans could keep passing budgets that the Democratic governor won't accept, meaning you have to keep rewriting it until you get one that he won't veto if you're unable to override the vetoes. So then the question becomes a political one, it seems to me, and I don't know how this is playing out in the legislature, and that is whose benefit is it, or to whose benefit does it work to hold up the budget process, to make this budget process linger? Maybe you can first tell us what happens if we don't have a budget, if it's vetoed, and then what are the politics and how it plays out in the next election cycle if we hold up the budget for too long?
Sure. So there is Republicans, to their credit, saw that this moment could come. They saw it a couple of years ago, and they passed a law that effectively takes previous spending levels, so the spending level that we're in right now, the budget that we're in this fiscal year, and sends it forward come July 1st. The fiscal year begins anew on July 1. So if there is not a budget that has been enacted into law by July 1, previous spending levels will continue. But there's an important caveat there. It's not for everything. It's just for recurring dollars, for things that have been funded for year over year. So for non-recurring things, those would not have funding moving forward into the 2020 fiscal year. And one notable example would be local government. So local governments, they need state money, just as the state relies on federal dollars. If we get to July 1st or 2nd or July 20th or 25th, and there hasn't been a budget passed, I think you're going to hear from a lot of municipalities around the state that need state dollars for certain things. I mean, there are a number of things that would not be funded because they are not recurring dollars. So that's kind of the functionality of it, or a functionality of part of it. In terms of the politics, it's a good question, and we don't know at this point who serves to dig his or her heels in the most, who would benefit the most, or who conversely would be harmed the most by that politically if they were to, you know, say, hold up this budget process for 2 or 3 or just to put it out there, 6 or 7 months. It's unclear who would be the biggest beneficiary of that.
All right. Let's talk about some of the ways in which this budget process plays out a little behind the scenes. And actually, I want to zero in on a proposed change, because very often there are big changes that happen in these budget negotiations that don't get discussed. In past years, certainly in this past, since 2010, a lot has happened behind closed doors and very late at night. And suddenly everybody finds out that there have been huge changes without much public scrutiny. And I want to bring our attention to one of those that may have happened were it not for the fact that you, Jeff, zeroed in on a proposed change, a change to the staff of the North Carolina Supreme Court Chief Justice. Tell us about that proposed priority.
So a week ago, there was a press conference Tuesday morning, the day after Memorial Day, in which senators rolled out the highlights of the budget, telling us about the percentage pay increase for state employees and, this provision and that provision. But the frustrating part from the reporter standpoint from us in the room was that we had not seen the budget. The budget was not out yet, yet there was a press conference and there begun the news cycle, this conversation about how great the spending plan was. We got the budget later on Tuesday, us reporters and the general public, and we start to sift through it. And one of the provisions that was in there was a proposed cut to the Chief Justice of the State Supreme Court, Sherry Beasley. She had been on the court for, is on the court, has been on the court for 6 years. She was elevated to Chief Justice by the governor back in the spring. She was elevated over the most senior member of the court. It has been generally customary for the most senior member of the court to be elevated to Chief Justice when there's a vacancy. The governor did not adhere to that. The person he bypassed was a Republican. So the proposed cut in the Senate budget last week would have slashed her staff from 6 to 3, would have given her only one law clerk, and she would have been the only appellate level judge in the state with one law clerk, and she is the highest jurist in the state. So it's a significant cut, and it's a significant cut as we think about some of the legal challenges that are before the state Supreme Court and some of the challenges we expect to come before the state Supreme Court the remainder of this year. And it, you know, in their words, Chief of Staff said that this would severely hamper their abilities to do what they needed to get done. So this is something we reported on. And as you may imagine, there was a lot of conversation on social media. Some other media outlets reported on it as well. And ultimately, on Friday morning, after an unsuccessful attempt by a Democrat to amend this provision and take it out of the state budget, a Republican amended the Senate's own provision on Friday morning to put back in this funding for the Chief Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court.
Well, this speaks to the need for better scrutiny and more time to be taken over these legislative priorities. And we've seen so much of that erode over the past few years. But let's talk about the ways in which these smaller political priorities play out. And take a look at the Senate budget. There are some changes there that are fairly interesting, moving departments, state departments to other parts of the state.
Yeah.
Talk more about some of those.
Yeah, a couple of just quick examples. One element of this state budget is to move the Department of Health and Human Services to Granville County. That, of course, is an hour away. It's a big change for thousands of people and would have a pretty significant impact on DHHS moving forward if that were to remain. There's also a proposed cut in the Senate budget of $38 million to Vidant Medical System, which is in the eastern part of the state, also would end the tie between Vidant and Brody Medical School, that being the big medical school in Greenville. And that specific example, not to go too far into the weeds, but that has to do with power, and that has to do with the board that governs, a governing board out there, and the legislature wants some more control over it. So you get into some of these policy proposals that really can have long-lasting and strong effects on folks. But again, as we noted off the top, this is just one step in a long process. So while it was in the Senate budget, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be in the final spending plan, which we hope to see here in a couple of
weeks. Talk about a non-budget item quickly. Today, the North Carolina House set to vote on overriding Governor Cooper's veto of the controversial so-called Born Alive Abortion Survivors Act. Remind us of this bill and where it stands now.
This is a bill that Republicans rolled out a couple months ago in response to legislative action that happened in New York and Virginia. There, in those states, they had rolled back late-term abortion restrictions. So here, they put forth this bill. What this bill would do is punish doctors who don't take care of a child who is born alive following a late-term abortion. Now, there's no evidence or indication that this has happened here or has happened here recently, but they moved forward with that legislation. The governor vetoed it. One Democrat sided with Republicans in the Senate to override the governor's veto, and now today in the House, there's going to be an override vote. From our calculus, at the moment, they don't have the votes to override the governor's veto. Ultimately, this is about politics. This is about trying to go after some Democrats who would not support this legislation, and we'll see. We have a vote coming up on this later this afternoon.
All right, we will stay tuned. Jeff Tiberi, WNC Capital Bureau Chief. Thank you, Jeff.
You're welcome, Frank.
The links to his reporting are at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, she survived Columbine. Casey Johnson shares the long and painful process of her journey in her new book. We'll talk about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us.